KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Two diseases, one in animals and one in humans, indicate difficulties officials have in containing highly contagious infections despite their best efforts. Once considered eradicated, measles is making a comeback in the U.S. despite clear scientific evidence on how to fight it. And tribal wildlife officials cannot adequately contain chronic wasting disease among deer and elk, even with major control measures. We'll hear about these two separate disease control efforts coming up after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Federal regulators said in a hearing Tuesday that data does not support a Wisconsin tribe's claims that a pipeline project will violate its water quality standards. As Danielle Kading reports, the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa says Canadian energy firm Enbridge is underestimating impacts from its Line 5 reroute.
Enbridge wants to reroute the oil and gas pipeline after Bad River sued to shut down and remove Line 5 from its lands. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers held a hearing over the tribe's objection to permitting the project under the Clean Water Act. The Environmental Protection Agency says Bad River didn't submit data or studies that show water quality violations would occur. But Bad River Tribal Chair Robert Blanchard says permitting the project would cause irreparable harm.
Whatever happens upstream from our reservation will affect the waters that we and many others depend on for survival.
Enbridge's Environmental Projects Manager Joe McGaver disputes that.
The Line 5 project will not impact Bad River's water quality standards. We designed the project for that to be the end result.
The tribe says the reroute would have a negative impact by filling wetlands, blasting bedrock, and disrupting groundwater flows. Enbridge and its consultants say wetland impacts will be temporary and blasting won't affect groundwater or nearby wells. For National Native News, I'm Danielle Kading.
And a disclosure, Enbridge supports this program. The federal government may soon return a traditional subsistence site connected to Douglas Island in southeast Alaska to its original tribal owners. KTOO's Clarice Larson reports.
Mayflower Island is a small 3-acre island adjacent to Douglas Harbor in Sandy Beach. It's near the site of the former Douglas Indian Village, which Douglas's city government burned down in 1962. The city and borough of Juneau formally apologized for the burning last fall. At a Juneau Assembly Lands Housing and Economic Development meeting last week, members gave initial approval for a plan that would acquire the island from the federal government and then give it to Douglas Indian Association. DIA officials did not respond to KTOO for a request for comment. Dan Blydorn is the city's land and resource manager. He says this is a plan that's been years in the making.
This is on the list of 2025 Assembly Goals for Community Wellness and Public Safety. The goal states, support Douglas Indian Association's efforts to acquire Mayflower Island.
The island once served as a traditional subsistence site and yielded a herring run and spawn used by the Douglas Indian Village. The DIA is currently in the process of building a cultural learning center near the former site of the village. According to a spokesperson for the U.S. Bureau of Land Management, the property has been under the federal government's stewardship since 1890. The island was originally reserved for the U.S. Navy to use as a naval station. But in 1948, it was transferred to the Federal Bureau of Mines, which constructed a mineral laboratory on the site to process ore samples for research. The BLM took over the property in 1996 when Congress closed the Bureau of Mines. The U.S. Coast Guard also used the site under an agreement with the BLM, but that ended in 2023. Blydorn says the actual property transfer is likely still a few years out, but the Juneau Assembly's approval is the next step in moving that process along. The resolution would still need to come before the Assembly for final approval. In Juneau, I'm Clarice Larson.
The U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs is holding a hearing Wednesday on public health and social services for Native Americans. The hearing will examine federal programs serving Native Americans across the Department of Health and Human Services. The hearing comes as the committee's leaders, Senators Lisa Murkowski and Brian Schatz recently sent a letter to Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., raising concerns about potential impacts on Native communities with Trump administration workforce reductions and funding cuts. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Skook Dash. For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods. Tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show. Om Nye. DT Track, your healthcare partner across Indian country, supports this show. DT Track provides culturally competent nationwide healthcare staffing to IHS, tribal, and urban health facilities. More at dt-track.com. Support by Siri, with a diverse and strategic investment portfolio for the long-term benefit of their shareholders. Investing in energy, infrastructure, real estate, government services, and more. Information is available at CIRI.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Officials with the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes in Montana documented their first case of a disease fatal to deer and other large game animals in January. Chronic wasting disease was already detected in animals elsewhere in the state and is on the rise across the country despite efforts to contain it. Tribal wildlife officials are put on the front lines of managing its spread. And now, federal funding cuts are jeopardizing efforts to monitor and research the disease. We'll talk with experts involved in managing the growing chronic wasting disease problem, and a little later we'll get updates on the increasing spread of measles across the country. You can join this conversation with comments and questions. Call us at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. You can also leave a comment on our website, NativeAmericaCalling.com, and our social media pages, Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky, and Threads. Let's now meet today's guests. Joining us from New York is Dean Seneca. He is the CEO of Seneca Scientific Solutions Plus and a health professor at the University of Buffalo and the University of Rochester. He is Seneca. Dean, hello, and welcome back to Native America Calling.
Hello. Thanks for having me. Glad to be back.
Glad to have you. Joining us from St. Paul, Minnesota is Tiffany Wolf. She is an associate professor in the Department of Veterinary Population Medicine and co-director of Minnesota Center for Prion Research and Outreach at the University of Minnesota. Tiffany, hello, and welcome to Native America Calling.
Hi, Sean. I'm very happy to be here.
Very happy to have you, Tiffany. And joining us from Madison, Wisconsin, is Erin Larson. She is a deer herd health specialist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Hello, Erin. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
All right. Well, Dean, I want to begin with you. Chronic wasting disease, it's always fatal for deer, elk, and moose that contact it or get in, you know, contract the disease. But what are the main concerns about this disease? It only affects large game animals.
Yeah, that's what we're seeing, is that primarily in deer, elk, and moose. It's really a disease that is spread through the animals. We haven't seen it in the human population yet. I mean, this disease really can decimate populations of deer, elk, and moose. It's significant, especially for our subsistence populations among our indigenous communities. This can have a severe impact on a primary food source for many of our tribal communities. It's sad that it has exploded this much. When I was epidemiology director at Great Lakes Intertribal Council, you know, we saw this disease among a lot of the deer population. And, you know, there's really nothing you can do in many cases. There are a few things you can do. One is try to isolate the populations as much as possible between those that are infected and those that are not infected. Any wasting disease or carcasses or anything that you see in the environment, properly dispose of them and get them out of the environment, because other animals will eat those carcasses and things and then potentially spread that disease amongst their populations. But to be honest with you, unless there's other preventive methods that have been known to work, we really need a lot more research among our animal populations regarding this disease.
So far, there are no human infections, but what about hunters, native people who go out, they hunt deer, they hunt elk, and they might consume that meat? What if by chance they consume meat from infected animals?
Well, you know, people run the risk of getting sick or severely ill, which could be easily diagnosed as another illness like the flu or some milder form of like a hemorrhagic fever or something like that. I don't know of anyone who has come into contact that way. But, you know, one of the big preventive methods, too, is to make sure that all of your hunting tools and things are, you know, cleaned and sterilized and properly, you know, put away after they've been used, you know. So that helps significantly. Trying to keep everything clean and sterile and in the hunting environment can be a challenge. But you try to do the best that you can in order to protect yourself and your family and your community.
Dean, is there a precedence here? We know how bird flu, swine flu, and mad cow disease cause serious concern from public health officials. Does chronic wasting disease, does it rise to that level at this point?
Not that I know of, but that is a good analogy. You know, among like the H1N1s and the bird flus, and, you know, that has kind of moved into the cow population. You know, we're always watching, you know, especially for farmers or any food handlers or veterinarians, to see if this the viruses that in the animal population actually transfers over to the human population. And in a handful of cases, I think in the last outbreak of the H1s, N1s, you know, we only saw that in one occurrence. Right. So, you know, but if it does mutate where it can run rapid in the human population, that could easily be our next pandemic. Right. I haven't seen any indication of that with the wasting disease in deer, elk, and moose. That's not to say that it could not happen. You know, like I said, we definitely need more research in this area to look at the wasting disease in our animal population to see even if that is a possibility of that virus transmitting over to the human population.
Thanks, Dean. Tiffany, I want to bring you into the conversation now. Chronic wasting disease, it also goes by the name zombie deer disease. Can you give us some more background on the effect this disease has on the animals it infects?
Sure. So this is as the name implies, it's a very long-term disease. As Dean mentioned already, it's 100% fatal as we know it in all of the cervid species in North America, like our deer, our elk, our moose. They're all susceptible to this disease. It's caused by a protein, and it's a protein that these animals normally have in their body, but the infectious form, the only difference between that and the natural form is it's misfolded, and that misfolded prion protein causes other prion proteins in the body to also misfold, and that takes a very long time, and that long time, I mean months to years. So deer that are infected with chronic wasting disease can look normal and healthy for many, many months. And towards the end stages of the disease, as more of the neurological tissues that are affected by the misfolded prion protein become damaged, then they start to show clinical signs of the disease. And that can look like poor body condition, so they can look really skinny. They can have a really rough and poor hair coat. Their behavior can change. An example is they may lose their fear of humans or their responses to other animals or elements in the environment may be different. Excessive drooling and drinking have also been observed. But again, it takes a really, really long time for animals to reach the point where we can observe that they are affected by this chronic wasting disease. But Tiffany, it's exactly as the name implies, it's wasting.
Okay. Now, you use the term misfolded proteins. Without getting too technical, I'm curious to know, what do you mean by that? What is a misfolded protein?
Yeah, so we our bodies are made up entirely of proteins, and a lot of those proteins have a function. They help our cells do their functions, our cells, our tissue functions, et cetera. So, and these prion proteins, all mammals have them. They're part of the normal body and help with normal cell functions. The only difference is that the shape of the protein is changed. So if we were in person, if we were live on TV, for example, I'd probably be holding a Slinky right now. We use Slinky toys to talk about how the concept behind this misfolding. So if you think about a Slinky, its fun is purely a function of its shape, right? You can imagine in your mind what a Slinky toy looks like as the spiral coils allow you to move it back and forth. But as soon as you get that Slinky into the hands of a 2 or 3 year old and they start really playing with it, bending it, misshaping it, it loses that dynamic coiling effect. And it's not as fun as a normally shaped Slinky is. And this is the same thing as these prion proteins, in that their normal shape changes, and they are no longer able to do the function that they would normally do for the body. And that causes cell death and tissues to change. And then again, over time, what we start to see is those deer start to look unwell.
Tiffany Wolf and Dean Seneca kicking off our conversation here today on Native America Calling. We were talking about chronic wasting disease. It's been detected in animals in different parts of the United States. We're going to take a short break and we'll continue our conversation. And the phone lines are open for any listeners who would like to join us. 1-800-996-2848. 1-800-996-2848. Native Americans are among those reflecting on the end of the Vietnam War 50 years after the infamous fall of Saigon. Estimates suggest no other group served in Vietnam at a higher rate than Native Americans, and Native veterans suffered the effects afterwards. We'll talk with Native veterans about their perspectives 5 decades later on the next Native America Calling.
Trickster Cultural Center, an authentic first voice of Native American veterans and cultural arts, will host the 2025 Summer Youth Powwow to foster community relations, youth literacy, cultural exchange, and provide local community resources. Trickster Cultural Center's Summer Youth Powwow is open to the public at no charge and takes place May 31st in Schaumburg, Illinois. More at TricksterCulturalCenter.org/summer-youth-powwow-2025. Trickster Cultural Center supports this show.
Oh, Thank you for listening to Native America Calling today. We're hearing about a disease that continues to spread among deer and elk and other big game animals that is a cause for concern among many tribal wildlife officials. So far, there is no threat to humans, but the possibility is a concern that public health officials are monitoring. Have you encountered chronic wasting disease? Let us know at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Let's hear now from Carrie Kingery. She is the Wildlife Program Manager and a tribal member of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes. The Flathead Reservation in Montana confirmed its first case of chronic wasting disease in January. She talked to us about that case and what it potentially means for her community going forward.
We did have our first detection of chronic wasting disease back in January. We had one animal come through with a positive test, so we implemented our CWD surveillance and response plan, which called that we then do a culling of animals to determine what our prevalence is. So now that we had it on the landscape, we needed to know how widespread and how frequent it was out on the landscape, how many animals in the herd had it. And so we were trying to, unfortunately, it was kind of butting up right at the end of our general hunting season for deer and elk. And so we tried to coordinate a specific hunt to get our hunters involved to help us reach that sample size, but we weren't able to get the season extended, and we kind of butted up against some, you know, below 30 weather for a couple of weeks that prevented our administrative staff from getting out and harvesting animals as well. So we weren't really able to collect enough samples to determine how prevalent it is on the landscape. But currently, you know, we do only have the one detection positive.
What are the challenges with monitoring CWD?
Some of the bigger challenges is staffing and finding funding, you know, to be able to hire staff to run check stations. So the, you know, positive detection that we had was because of one of our stations up north. And so it just really shows us that it is important in being able to maintain those. But unfortunately, our funding that was paying for those check stations was federal funding and is not available this year. So we're having to try to navigate additional routes. I think nationally, you know, we will see a kind of change in focus for managing chronic wasting disease with the budget cuts. And I know there was a lot of research that was being conducted that were multiple year projects. And so whether they continue to get funding, I'm not sure. When I was kind of attending some of the grant recipient symposiums, you know, a lot of the tribes were just using the federal funding for monitoring, you know, just hosting check stations and processing the samples. It can be pretty costly. And so without that federal funding available, I think, you know, that just the overall ability to monitor and survey, you know, do surveys for CWD is going to be a lot more difficult.
What threat does chronic wasting disease pose for Confederated Salish and Kootenai citizens on a cultural level?
Absolutely. So one of the biggest concerns that we have with chronic wasting disease is that, you know, it can pretty significantly impact wild ungulate populations. And so, you know, we currently have very robust populations of deer and elk. And so the concern is that, you know, if we have high prevalence, then it can spread pretty quickly through the different herds across the reservation, and that has long-term impacts to food sovereignty. As our herds decline, you know, some areas see up to 40% decline in populations each year, and so over time, that's going to have a big impact on the big game that we see on the reservation. So that's kind of the main thing, is that food sovereignty issue. And then another being, you know, there's a lot of additional uses with animals that are harvested than most state hunters. We're using different pieces. We're using the brain to tie to tan hides. We're using all these different elements of the carcass, the animal, that could have additional routes of exposure to tribal members. So another thing that we're really trying to convey and urge to our membership is to not use parts of the animal until you've had it tested and know for sure that it's a negative for CWD, because we don't want kind of that additional exposure outside of cooked meat to our membership.
That was Carrie Kingery, Wildlife Program Manager for the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes, speaking with NAC producer Sol Traverso about chronic wasting disease on the Flathead Reservation in Montana. Dean Seneca, I'd like you to comment here because Carrie mentioned that her tribe needed additional funding routes because of federal budget cuts. How do you see tribes being affected if they have to pay for monitoring CWD and other diseases themselves?
Oh, well, you know, what's going on at the federal level is eventually going to devastate any kind of research and additional monies coming to universities. Our tribal colleges are already seeing the impact of it, and our local schools are going to see the next impact of it. So, you know, with limited amount of money, you know, our ability to actually do more extensive research in this area, our ability to kind of try to look at the populations and isolate them so that the infected don't get in contact with the uninfected. And these are monumental tasks. These are not things that are easily to do, especially amongst a wild animal population. Our ability to respond is going to be very, very limited. It's going to be devastating. So, you know, things like this that can impact, our subsistence populations, our environment, these things could easily get out of control if we don't designate resources to it immediately. And I can't emphasize that enough because we're not only seeing that with these kinds of illnesses, but we're also seeing that across other research for cancers, research for diabetes, and other things that are going to impact the health of the entire U.S. population. We haven't seen the immediate impacts yet because it's relatively a short period of time. It's only been within the last month or two where these cuts have happened. But within the next 3 months, we're going to see the real impacts to what the federal government is doing to our local populations.
Tiffany Wolf, I'd like you to chime in because these cuts to research on the federal level, that does also include scientific research. What concerns do you have about the future of research and monitoring going forward?
I would echo the same concerns that Dean has. We have research has really ramped up in these past several years related specifically to CWD, and we've learned a lot. We've learned so much. There's also been a lot of funding that has really been put towards and dedicated towards surveillance, and as a result, we have a better idea of where CWD is on the landscape. But we're not done yet. There's so much more that we know that we need to understand. Things about transmission, things related to control. Right now, we don't have vaccines, we don't have therapeutics, and there's really a lot of concerns about how well some of the management strategies that we're using are at controlling CWD in different contexts. And research is going to really get us there. The research is needed to get further down those pathways to help us understand where we can be most effective in our control of this disease in cervids. And there's such an important group of animals for many of us. We're still trying to understand fully the long-term population effects in a lot of different places as we're starting to see it emerge in different parts of the U.S. and Canada. And so all of that is done using research and the tools like surveillance and management.
Tiffany, about 34 states have detected CWD cases, chronic wasting disease. What's the potential of it spreading more globally or even becoming endemic?
Well, I think there are a lot of locations in the U.S. and Canada where CWD is now considered endemic. Minnesota, for example, we saw CWD emerge in the southeastern part of Minnesota around 2010. Our DNR, our state DNR, has done a lot of work and effort to control its spread and also to see if we could eliminate it from that part of the state. And up just last year, the state DNR changed the classification to endemic in that part of the state, recognizing that it is not going away and prevalence is starting to increase as this much time has passed. And that's not out of the ordinary from what has been observed elsewhere in the U.S. In regard to moving it internationally, we have seen that moving deer or other cervids across international borders can result in the transportation of the disease as well. That occurred when I believe it was elk were transported from Canada to South Korea. There's also evidence that CWD has emerged independently in other countries. So some of our Scandinavian countries, Norway, Sweden, Finland, they have now detected CWD, but there is no epidemiological link between CWD in the U.S. or CWD in North America and what they're observing in the Scandinavian countries.
All right. Thank you, Tiffany. Let's bring Erin Larson into our conversation now. She's in Madison, Wisconsin, where she is a deer herd health specialist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Erin, hello again. And what's the current threat level of chronic wasting disease in Wisconsin? Give us an update.
Yeah, so Wisconsin had detected CWD quite a bit earlier than our neighbor Minnesota, where Tiffany is. We first detected it in 2002, so it's been over two decades now that we've had this disease in Wisconsin. Unfortunately, we have seen geographic spread, but we still do have the majority, about 90% of our positives are contained in the southern part of the state. So although we're seeing that spread, we still do have a lot of areas where it appears our prevalence rates or numbers of positives are much lower. And in those areas, we do still have the ability to potentially keep those areas at a low prevalence for the disease.
What's the current state management plan for handling CWD?
Yeah, we are actually working on updating our plan. So we did release a plan in 2010. It was a 15-year plan, so it goes through 2025, but we are actually in the process of updating that plan as well, hoping to come out probably in 2026. You know, there are factors of the plan we haven't been able to fully implement due to some, you know, a variety of reasons, some social and political non-support that we've had, but we certainly are continuing to try to fight the fight with chronic wasting disease and continue to learn what we can. You know, what Tiffany kind of alluded to, maybe in the future there'll be additional tools that we're able to utilize to help with chronic wasting disease management.
And this plan that you're working on now, how is it going to differ from strategies that have been implemented in the past?
Yeah, at this time, it's too early to be able to share what will be included in that, as it's very much still a draft plan. But we do want to be potentially focus on some of those areas outside of the South. We talked a little bit about endemic areas. Our southern part of Wisconsin, especially Southwest, is what we consider endemic for CWD in Wisconsin. But we do have a lot of other areas that the prevalence does seem to be very low where we have detected it. So being able to potentially concentrate in some of those areas and try some more management strategies in those areas to keep that prevalence at a very low rate.
It sounds like states differ in their management approaches. Does some of it have to do with geography? Does some of it have to do with just the nature of how the disease is impacting certain herds? I'm curious.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of differences in between states and how their agencies, their natural resources agencies are able to operate would be one. You know, what the deer density and deer range is in that state, the level of hunting. And in Wisconsin, hunting is extremely important to our public and our citizens. There's a very longstanding tradition of deer hunting, and it's very important to a lot of people. So there's a lot of passion and a lot of opinions about what's happening within our state for deer hunting and deer management.
Now, you've just stressed the fact that many of these hunters are perhaps on the front line in regards to dealing with this disease, and Dean Seneca said something similar. What more can you tell hunters about what they can do to prevent the spread of the disease?
Yeah, having that partnership with hunters is huge. And so some of the things that we talk with our hunters about is encouraging them to continue to hunt. You know, we want people to be able to still enjoy this as a tradition and as an activity they can share with their families and friends. But it also can be a management tool to help continue to keep the harvest rates up in those areas, especially where CWD has been detected. We also have areas that we're asking for additional samples for every year. So we put out a surveillance plan where we really need to have some more samples submitted to determine what the disease density is in that area. In Wisconsin, we also catalog every single sick deer report that is submitted to us. So we encourage folks to let us know if they see a sick deer on the landscape, because that could be potentially a deer that has chronic wasting disease. And if it's in a new area, that's valuable information to us. So having those eyes and ears out there and communicating with this is invaluable.
All right. Thank you, Erin Larson, joining the conversation. She is in Wisconsin, and she is part of the effort here to educate our listeners about chronic wasting disease. She's a deer herd health specialist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And we have the phone lines open. I'd like to hear from some hunters today. If you make it a point to go out and hunt every season, or maybe you live a subsistence lifestyle and you're out there often hunting and going out there and securing game for your own needs and the needs of your family and your community, I'd like to hear what you think about chronic wasting disease. Have you ever encountered it, or do you have concerns about how you're going to be hunting going forward in the months and possibly years to come? You can share your perspectives, you can share your insights, you can share your knowledge and experience. Just give us a call. Phone lines are open, and the number is 1-800-996-2848. 1-800-996-2848. Hunters across Indian Country, I want to hear from you. 1-800-99-NATIVE. Join the conversation.
Challenges to societal harmony abound. Trauma, depression, addiction. In Native communities, these challenges affect nearly everyone. The Native American Social Work Studies Institute educates social workers for careers to address the needs of Native communities. You can be part of the solution as a peer support worker, community health worker, or a counselor with culturally relevant training from the Native American Social Work Studies Institute. Info at online.nmhu.edu. New Mexico Highlands University supports this show. Did you know that one person can save up to 8 lives and heal dozens more through the gift of organ and tissue donation? Give hope to thousands of people across the U.S. waiting for a life-saving organ transplant. Learn more about the power of organ, eye, and tissue donation with Life Center Northwest, the organ procurement organization serving all of Alaska, at lcnw.org. That's lcnw.org. Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian Country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com. Support provided by Alaska Growth Capital. The Aleut Marketplace is now open. Aleut Corporation shareholders and registered descendants are eligible. Applications are available at alaskagrowth.com under Marketplace. Support for this program provided by ConocoPhillips Alaska, operating in Alaska for more than 50 years. and valuing the opportunity to partner with Alaska Native communities.
We're glad you're able to join us today on Native America Calling. Measles are an increasing public health threat, even though it is easily prevented with vaccines. Right now, more than 1,000 people are infected with measles in the United States. The Health and Human Services Secretary is appearing before Congress today, in part to give an update on what the federal government can do to improve those numbers. You can join our conversation right now. Call in at 1-800-996-2848. We're going to talk more about measles in just a moment, but we did have a caller. They don't want to come on the air, but they have a question. And Tiffany Wolf, I'd like you to respond to this question. It is, where and how did chronic wasting disease start? Tiffany, what can you tell us?
Great question. Chronic wasting disease was first identified in Colorado in the 1960s. It was first recognized as a syndrome. So basically just, you know, an unidentified disease of mule deer. It was also later identified in Wisconsin and Saskatchewan. And it was in these western parts of the country for a long, long period of time until, as Aaron mentioned, in 2002 was the first time it was detected east of the Mississippi River, and that was in Wisconsin. So it was first emerged in 1967 in Colorado. It wasn't until the early 1980s that scientists were able to determine that it was caused by a prion protein, and it was similar to other encephalopathies or neurologic diseases of other species. Similar, not the same, though.
All right. Appreciate all your expertise, Tiffany. Aaron, would you like to add anything with regard to the origin of CWD or any other insights you can share with our listeners about this threat here?
Yeah, you know, as Tiffany mentioned, yeah, that was first found on the captive mule deer, and you know, Wisconsin was one of the first states, but unfortunately, we have seen a lot of other states now that have found chronic wasting disease. Illinois was shortly after Wisconsin, and in the northern part of the state, so you know, you could see there potentially was some overlap. We don't know how chronic wasting disease came to be in some of these states early on, Wisconsin being the example I'll use, because it was one of the first. We don't know how it got here. We likely never will. However, what I can say is when we first started testing just a few years earlier in 1999, prior to when we found it, and after we found it, we did very extensive testing, much more than we had been doing as more of just the precaution prior to when we detected it. And what we found after doing an extensive testing process after the first detections is it was already widespread, unfortunately, in southern Wisconsin. We weren't detecting it right after introduction. So, you know, some states may be able to find it earlier, have found it earlier, and are able to contain it more than Wisconsin is able to.
Thank you very much, Aaron. Let's now talk more about measles. And to do that, we're going to go back to Dean Seneca, CEO of Seneca Scientific Solutions. And Dean, measles cases nationwide, they've surpassed 1,000, and they're present in at least 30 states. Many of those cases have been reported in Texas. There's now discussion about measles becoming endemic. Can you tell us more? What exactly does that mean, endemic?
That means that we're going to have a significant rise in measles cases throughout the whole country. And as vaccinations decrease, we will see increases of infectious diseases, and measles being primarily one of the most infectious diseases that we have on record. We could see definitely a huge increase in cases throughout the whole country. And this is totally preventable. You know, a little epi on it right now. We have 1,001 cases. Of those cases, it's really grouped between the ages of under 5 years, 5 to 19, and 20 plus years. The majority of the cases are between the 5 to 19 year olds. And the vast majority, almost 99% of these cases, are among the unvaccinated. Hospitalization sits at about 13% of those cases, so about 120, 130 of those cases are people are in the hospital. Children under 5 years have the highest hospitalization percentage, followed by the 5 to 19-year-olds. And we have 3 confirmed deaths. Listen, I did 3 months of measles work on a stop assignment in Ethiopia, Africa. And I would look at whole villages of kids impacted by measles and the amount of pain that the children received during this, the amount of crying, the amount of suffering that children experience while being infected with the disease is just awful, terrifying. Terrifying for parents. And it's unnecessary because the MMR vaccine works. That's the bottom line. It works. And overwhelmingly, and I just need to make this statement, overwhelmingly, scientists have conducted extensive research over the entire world for the last 2 decades. And to examine the link between childhood vaccinations and autism. And the results of this research is clear and overwhelming. Vaccines do not cause autism. So there's no reason for us to have this measles outbreak the way that we do, especially in the United States.
And Dean, in areas where we're seeing lower vaccination rates, like, for example, the Fargo Forum, they reported this week that there are at least 800 public school students in Fargo, North Dakota schools who are not vaccinated against measles. That's just one city. What's the potential in places like that where they're not, you're just not seeing large vaccination numbers?
Well, then, you know, if there's a person that has measles and they're in one end of the room or a corridor or a hallway, you know, this virus literally is a airborne virus. It's it can stay in the air for like up to 2 hours. It's the most infectious virus that I've ever had the firsthand experience of working on. And, you know, you could be literally at the other end of the hallway, the under end of the corridor, and totally at the other end of the room and get infected with this virus. It's that infectious. And, you know, what does that mean? That means that we're going to see higher cases of measles in areas where there are, people are unvaccinated. And it's uncalled for. It's unnecessary. We don't need to have measles at the rates that we're having here in this country. And that is because of skepticism. That is because of vaccine misinformation that is flooding social media. And, you know, I really do think that these unvaccinators or people that don't support vaccinations, you know, are doing a huge amount of public harm, almost in a criminal matter, to the rest of the U.S. public, because they are sending and providing a lot of misinformation throughout the whole country in many different forms, you know, doctoring videotapes and, you know, using AI to send different kind of messages. This is just has to stop. I mean, it's just awful. And the Secretary Kennedy, Secretary of Health and Human Services, has to stand up to this misinformation and get the correct information out there for the United States so that people can immunize themselves and immunize their children so we don't have this virus running rampant throughout the country. It's totally unnecessary and uncalled for.
Dean, let's talk more about treatment for measles, because Secretary Kennedy has made claims that vitamin A and cod liver oil are effective treatments for measles. Is that true? And if not, what are the most effective treatments for measles?
These things may boost an immune response, their immunity, but they are nowhere effective treatments for measles. They're not even on the spectrum. The most effective treatment for measles is to get vaccinated. That's the most effective means to address measles. You know, there's nothing really that you can take. There's a lot of things that you could take to spark your immunity, you know, to build your immune system. But will it stop the virus? No, it won't. Overwhelmingly, we've seen so many studies and so much research in this area for decades where, you know, the natural immune response system is not going to stop a measles virus from attacking you, right? What will stop it is the MMR vaccine.
Okay, so let's say, though, that somebody, maybe somebody listening right now, they have a child or a grandchild who comes down with measles. What's the recommendation? How do they just handle that at home? How do they treat it? What can they do?
Well, you know, first and foremost, to seek medical attention, you know, get the child or the person to the doctor to kind of see where they are and you know, with the virus. The most effective treatment is hydration. You know, drinking a lot of water, keeping your body hydrated. And if you are infected, you're just going to have to, you know, do things to keep your immunity very, very high. And, you know, you're going to have to fight through the virus. You know, things to keep your fever down, keep hydrated, and things to address any kind of skin lesions and things. So you might have to use creams and things to dry out the measles virus reaction on your skin. Those kinds of things. You know, most importantly, though, is to stay hydrated and to seek medical attention.
All right. And how long does a typical case of measles last?
Oh, like 2 weeks. 2 weeks. When I was in Ethiopia, I would see children that were impacted for 3 weeks, but the long-term effects are huge. You know, a measles virus could impact you the rest of your life. You know, you could see ailments and things that, you know, regarding, you know, susceptibility to other viruses and illnesses. You know, they have other chronic conditions that could result from a measles infection. There are definitely long-term effects related to measles, and many of them.
Dean, your experience working in Ethiopia, that's poignant. And I want to ask you also, based on what you learned there and what you saw, what's been the historical toll that measles has had on Native people here in North America?
Oh, well, you know, measles is linked to smallpox, and we all know that smallpox has decimated Indian populations throughout the country. You know, right now, Texas has the highest number of cases of measles, and, you know, surrounding states with large Indian populations, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and Kansas. You know, this virus could easily, you know, impact our communities there. You know, there is a chickenpox outbreak in many of our tribal communities throughout the country right now. This virus and the susceptibility linked to that could, you know, cause massive outbreaks in many of our communities. The measles is something that we have to take serious, because it lowers your immune system and makes you susceptible to a lot of other things. And the problem is we need to get vaccinated. You know, you get vaccinated, you'll be protected from this, awful virus. Virus, along with others like smallpox, and other chronic health conditions like diabetes, our indigenous populations are severely impacted. And you know, this could just add to the disease burden and life longevity of our populations. So it's unnecessary. We don't need it. We need to do the proper things in order to protect our communities, protect our children. Okay. From it.
Well, tell us more about the vaccine. Is it a single dose? Is it an oral application? Is it a shot? How easy is it for somebody to get vaccinated for measles right now?
So basically, it's very, very easy, right? You know, one thing I want to say is that, you know, for women who are vaccinated, and they are with child or they're pregnant, they pass that immunity to their unborn. If they're not vaccinated, well, then their child is even more susceptible to a measles outbreak. I just wanted to make that point. But basically, the vaccination is two doses. That first dose is between 12 and 15 months. We can't vaccinate a child that's under 12 months, under 1 year old. And then the second dose is at 4 to 6 years. So, you know, relatively easy, one shot, and after two doses, you're vaccinated and you're protected from the virus.
All right. And what about somebody older, maybe somebody middle-aged, maybe somebody in their 50s? Should they, maybe they got vaccinated many years ago as a child. What do you recommend for those folks?
They should be protected if they got vaccinated a long time ago. They should be good for people who are older. To be honest with you, I would recommend a shingles vaccine. Because I know many of our tribal elders who have recently got shingles, and they were literally telling me that they wish they would have been vaccinated, that it was the most painful reaction to a virus that they've ever had. And they pleaded with me to go preach to other Native elders to get the shingles vaccine. And I've seen that in many cases amongst our elders throughout all of Indian country.
All right. Really appreciate Dean Seneca, along with our other guests, Tiffany Wolf, Aaron Larson, and Carrie Kingery, for joining our conversation here today on Native America Calling. We're out of time, so we're going to have to wrap up, but we will be back again tomorrow, and we'll hear from Native military veterans about what the country has learned in the 50 years since the end of the Vietnam War. I'm Sean Spruce. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Support from Dartmouth College hosting its Tribal Leadership Academy July 28th to August 2nd in New Hampshire. Up to 25 new or appointed tribal government leaders and a group of experienced presenters will consider intergovernmental relations, economic development, healthcare, natural resources, and tribal law and order. Dartmouth College will cover the travel and attendance costs. Application available at dartmouthtriballeadershipacademy.com. Application deadline is May 16th, 2025. Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite.